Welcome to the Living Undeterred podcast. As I mentioned previously, this is a rebranding effort. I did the podcast for 3 years, took a year off to build a little bit what we're going to talk about today, the Brighton experience. And today I have a great guest. I'm super excited to have this conversation because I think a lot of people watching this show we'll be able to pull them in because most people are going to be able to attribute some part of their life to what we're going to discuss in the next few minutes. But Dr. Nate or Nate, which do you prefer?
Dr. Nate is fine.
Dr. Yep. Nate. Okay. Dr. Nate Harold with Med One is here today. Now, Med One is a great story. I'm going to have you share a little bit about what Med One stands for and how we kind of got hooked up together. But we're very grateful at Brighton and at Living Undeterred to have this opportunity to bring you in today and talk about some of these challenges. I don't want to say problems because that's a negative mindset, but more of like the opportunities that are out there that we can figure out ways to improve the lived experience for people that are really struggling. You know, one of the big ironies for me is that as we keep adding more to our lives, it feels like there's more missing, right? So Dr. Nate, with that little intro, let's learn a little bit about you, why the pharmaceutical industry. I have some neat things on my agenda here I want to cover with you that may surprise you that my intern Ben found on your bio, but we can talk about that in a minute. But a little bit about Nate, Dr. Nate, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, and thanks for having me today. I come to you here in Iowa City, Iowa, where I'm coming back to my roots in pharmacy. Yeah. I was here for 4 years and studied at the University of Iowa. It's not actually where I'm from. I'm from Washington State. When I was in my 20s, my early 20s, I decided to leave home, figuring out life. I had actually dropped out of college at that point and decided to pack up my vehicle with a friend and made it out this way. So, yep, a West Coast kid that found himself now in the Midwest, and I serve as the chief pharmacy officer for a company called Med One Pharmacy Benefit Solutions. We started in 1999, and we offer services that allow for an employer to offer a prescription benefit for their employees. Those companies in the world are referred to as PBMs.
Right.
And PBMs actually have a pretty negative connotation. In fact, if you were to Google it today and look at the articles that are coming out, you'll see there's been a lot of FTC investigations, mm-hmm. Department of Labor, the government, just looking at the various practices that are going on in this particular industry, because it's one that has shown for about the last 30 to 40 years to do a certain amount of harm to our communities through scrupulous business practices. Mm-hmm. So you might wonder why Brighton and you and myself have chosen to partner in such a way, especially knowing that this is a challenging industry to be in. But a big part of that is we were founded on principles back in 1999 to really be the antithesis of all that negative behavior that was going on in the industry and try to find a much more altruistic way of administering a prescription benefit that was better for patients and also was better for employers, which is why in 2014, I decided to take on a role with this organization and see if there was something that we could do to, in some ways, break some of the behavior and the cycle that was going on in the industry, and then do better by our stakeholders, which are mainly patients and then employers, but ultimately it has an impact on our communities. If you would like to go even further back, we can talk a little bit about why I even went down the path of pharmacy to begin with and what that journey kind of looked like. I think that speaks a little bit more to maybe even why I decided to leave Washington when I was 20 years old and pursue something that was a little bit different. So, I was born and raised in Yakima, Washington, a community that is best known now for producing a lot of hops for making a beer around world. That's kind of its main claim. But when I was young, Apple Orchards Agricultural Community, right on the foothills of the Cascade Mountains.
Beautiful.
It's a neat place. Though I would say there's some challenges in that community as well. Mm-hmm. There's actually been a growing amount of gang related violence in the community, which I could kind of see through, especially my later and mid to late teen years. And they're facing those challenges. But as I was growing up, I came from a family that was very blue collar. My dad was a machinist. My mother worked at a restaurant until she had some health issues, which then led to her taking disability and then not working for the majority of my childhood. I was about 7 years old when she actually broke her leg on something called a skip it. And I'm sure some of your listeners might remember from the late 80s, early 90s,
skip it.
A toy that was basically an ankle breaker that came out. And basically there was a ring on one end. Connected to that was basically like a plastic tether and then a ball. And you'd put it around one ankle and you would skip around and it would count it. Yeah. Yeah. So these skip-its, I'm sure that they contributed directly to an increase of ER admissions. Yeah. So there's one night that it's like right after Christmas, and we had just gotten these as kids, and my parents have some friends over, and I wouldn't be surprised if there was alcohol involved, maybe other substances too. And she trips in our driveway, and she breaks her ankle. I'm 7 years old at the time, maybe even a little bit younger. And so she goes off to the ER, breaks her ankle, and they put it in a cast. And that was her first time kind of being out of work and then also, being prescribed, opioid medication.
I could see where this was going.
Yeah. So, she, healed very slowly, continued to be on those opioid medications. When she finally was back up on her feet again, she didn't really want to give up the use of those opioid medications. So, that kind of led to, a journey, I would say, for our family as well as for her, where, prior to this, and again, I was young, so some of my perception might be skewed, but, it seemed like we were a fairly normal family. But then after that point, now there was, a lot of issues that she was struggling with, and, struggled with major depressive disorder, had some, physicians, some providers that, she would go to and would start her on some different medications. And I think that for me as a, as a child, that was probably my first time that I ever interacted with a pharmacist in our community.
Wow.
Was, going with my mom, she'd have a doctor's appointment, going to the pharmacy, getting the medication. And I can clearly remember, this guy, in the pharmacy, elevated above everybody else, because back in those days, the pharmacies were set up so that the pharmacy actually was, taller, higher from a floor starting point compared to the rest of the store. Right. 'Cause it was actually intended to where you'd have to look up at the pharmacist.
Really?
Like it was almost like this psychological perception of this person is in an elevated state in comparison to those. It's actually been a big area of discussion, is remodeling pharmacies to get them so that these pharmacists aren't viewed as like they're up higher.
I've never
higher
thought than, of that before.
Yeah. So you might see that in some pharmacies where they're elevated, but a lot of pharmacies, they've brought that back down, and in some cases, right, they've closed them off so that you can't even really see what's going on much back in the pharmacy. But I remember seeing him, and he's got his white coat on, and he's doing his job, and he comes out and he talks to us about the medications. He seems smart. He seems respected. So I definitely had it in my mind that, hey, this person provided a lot of value and definitely instilled a lot of trust in the people that interacted with him. Didn't think at that time that I wanted to become a pharmacist, but that was probably my early perceptions of who this person was, and what that role looked like. Fast forward, my mom doesn't get particularly better. She, proceeds to get diagnosed with things like fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder. And now she's on a whole cocktail of medications, sure. right?
Yeah.
Even just keeping them straight is a challenge. But one thing that had not ever really gone away was the use of these opioid pain medications because she had gone from having an injury that ultimately had a legitimate cause for using these to then almost like a psychological process that convinced herself that, no, she needed these because there was something broken inside of her that that this helped support and treat. I would say that it really crossed over into true addiction in my mid-teen years. And that's where we start to see how these medications, when used inappropriately, can impact somebody's quality of life in a way that they don't want it to, meaning they want to live their life and be functional and a contributing member of our society in a particular way. And yet their dependence on these substances is preventing them from doing that. And I can remember some of the more difficult times where hearing some sort of crash in the hallway and then finding my mom just face down, passed out. And, you know, thinking, is this it? Did she pass away? Is something going on? And having to, you know, wake her up from like a stupor and recognizing that this is probably not appropriate. I think one of the challenges was her doctors, her providers, enabled this to happen. You know, she would go in and she would talk to him for 30 minutes and she would come out with prescriptions that just continued to allow this behavior to occur. And, I'm sure that there's nuances to that, that I'm not appreciating. And there were doctors that actually refused to see my mom during that time period. We reached a point too where, you know, she had the doctors that would just write for the prescriptions. And so this goes on through my teenage years, but what it instilled to me was a challenge at home that I had reached a point by the time I was in my 20s that, or my early 20s, that I was like, I don't know that I want to be back around this.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't say that I run away from many things in my life, but it would be hard for me not to challenge myself to say, nah, you were running away from some difficult circumstances.
Well, you were young too.
Yeah, very, very true. So as I then get to be 20 years old and I'd done some college, I had spent 2 years back home going to community college while I was still in high school. And then I did a study abroad in England, but I had this window that I was back home trying to kind of figure out what I wanted to do with my life and decided that I would, with a friend, come out to Iowa. And it was while I was here that the rest of my life kind of took its path that it did. So I took some time and figured out what I wanted to try for my next step from an education standpoint, decided on pharmacy, started the work it would take to get into pharmacy school and then completing pharmacy school. Then I went back home to Washington State to spend a couple years doing residency, doing some advanced training in emergency medicine. And then in 2014, came back to Iowa mainly because my wife's family is all here. We knew if we were going to plant roots and settle down, it was going to be in this community. And so we did. And for the last 11 years or so, I've dedicated a lot of my time around supporting this pharmacy business model, which is all set on bringing transparency and alignment in a space that lacks those things in abundance. So it's been rewarding work. It's definitely takes some time to find passion and fulfillment when you're going from working with patients in the emergency room to working with you know, a whole population, hundreds of thousands of patients that are seeking care and funding and access to care. But you definitely can find that in this work. And it does show that we can do a much broader reach of good across our communities than what I had been doing when I was working in emergency medicine.
Wow. There's a lot there. As you were telling your story, I couldn't help to think about what we went through in our family, which is common when people share stories. You project that into your own life. And I can just vividly remember my wife when she was really struggling with prescription addiction and alcohol, grief from losing our child, hearing that thud and coming upstairs and finding her in the hallway and having my two boys that were, at the time, 19 and 17, putting pillows under her head, as she had fallen down, whether she was too many prescriptions or alcohol, whatever. But as you're telling your story, I just was thinking about my story. Then I thought of how many people have these experiences out there, whether they're CEOs or entry-level people or doesn't matter. This stuff doesn't discriminate. And that's to hear your passion behind what you do now. I respect that a lot. Cause it's the same thing that drives me. When my wife died, she had, 12 prescription bottles next to her, or we found. So how she was in this era, doctor shopping, I have no idea how she was doing that, but, and I didn't recognize most of them. I had to go to the internet and research them with her sister. And we're like, how? And then you're drinking on top of it. And so, yeah, there's certainly, it's great that what you're doing, Nate, I'm really more impressed each time I talk to you about the passion behind what you do. And I think this is where I think you and I, Brighton and Med One, are trying to peel back that veil and then break these stigmas and these barriers to increasing human flourishing by having these conversations. And not going to lie, the first time that I talked about this potential partnership, there were some eyebrows went up, And I'm like, well, this is exactly why I want to have this partnership. Until people start to draw a line in the sand and say, enough's enough. There's 909 Americans die every day from the deaths of despair. Alcohol, suicide, overdose. My son Seth died from overdose. My wife died from alcohol. And I about killed myself 4 months later. Just my family would have had all three of those in a 5-year time span. That's just unfathomable and it's unacceptable to me. So kind of on the heels of what we just talked about, kind of the passion behind all this, let's talk about the current challenge that we have in front of us. And this is this mental health, mental wellness, mental illness, whatever term you want to put in there, epidemic that we have. Like, it's easy to sit back and say, oh, it's because of COVID or because of social media. But it's a lot deeper than that, as you know. Those are symptoms of the issue. Why are people on social media is the problem. Like, what's distracting them from their own life that they have to spend 4 hours on TikTok, and just feel worse and worse and worse as time goes on. So from a holistic aspect, maybe sprinkle in a little bit about your past experience and about what you do at Med One, but where do you see the future? Like, what gives you hope and inspiration that we, partnerships like this and other partnerships you have, that we can actually start to move this, right this sinking ship, that so many people are very concerned, me and you included?
Yeah, I think that the level of awareness has definitely shifted over the last
big time
10, 20
yep.
years.
Yep.
Whereas brain health was stigmatized for a very long time. Now there's a lot more attention, concern, sensitivity mm-hmm. around it. And that's good and bad in some ways. I think that sometimes is putting a spotlight on an issue can bring up additional levels of attention that some people might cope better without.
Right.
But I think that's the lesser of two evils, yeah. really. You think of very stoic individuals that their coping mechanism is actually through distraction and maybe a little bit of avoiding, avoidance. May not always be the best solution, but for some people, maybe that is a good solution mm-hmm. to making sure they're in a good place from a brain health and a well-being standpoint. And the attention that's provided, that can sometimes be a challenge to them.
Yeah.
But I think when we think about the majority of folks, it allows them to seek the care and the community that they need to make sure that they're in a good place and in the place that they want to be. I think as I look back at just what I've experienced from a brain health and a well-being standpoint, there's a lot of factors that I think have led to the challenges that we face as a society. And I'll speak a little bit more from where I'm professionally involved, which is on the pharmacy side.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely have gone through phases as a society where we view that the use of medications is a easy way to get some sort of outcome that we're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I was going through training, this concept of there's a pill for every ill is mainly driven by a capitalistic society that there's entities out there that are going to profit off of a mindset that I can take a pill to solve my problems.
Right.
The reality is life is a lot more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
And while medication and medicine can do a lot of good, you and I both have seen the evils of it as well. And a big part of why I went into pharmacy was trying to lend my time, talent, and expertise to helping people have a much more appropriate relationship with medication, knowing when it is the right tool for the job, but when it's not the right tool, and also when it's not the only tool. I think that's also one of the things that's challenging. And as we explored the partnership and even just the product that Brighton provides, health is one component of well-being, but wealth and purpose are two other equally weighted components of well-being and of brain health. And I mentioned before, I came from a blue-collar family. My childhood definitely had situations where my family, my parents fought over money and fought over how we're going to pay the bills and how we're going to provide for the type of lifestyle they wanted to have with very limited resources, and then what it looked like when you weren't responsible with those resources.
Yep.
And so, you know, as a child, seeing parents fight over money, and then you've got these health issues, and then the whole concept of a sense of purpose. All that's to say is I feel pretty comfortable in my understanding of the health piece and making sure that people set reasonable expectations of what medication should do for them and making sure they don't cross that line to having an inappropriate relationship with medication where it's doing them harm, or they don't fully appreciate or understand what they should get out of the use of that treatment. And then making sure that they incorporate all the other aspects of ensuring that their health is good besides just taking a medication for it. So I think when we looked at Brighton, the part of it that we thought would be really good for not just our members, our patients, as we offer this to all of our clients, but then to our own employees who are offered the use of the platform, is how it helps them understand how many different facets are incorporated in well-being and brain health.
Yep.
And that it's not going to be just therapy. It's not going to be just psychiatry. It's not going to be just medication. It's not going to be just financial security.
Yeah.
And it's not going to just be instilling a sense of purpose and value in what you're doing with your time and your talent. It's all of those things put together that ensures that you're on a, I'll say, somewhat stable foundation.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that it ever stays that stable, because life is complex and it changes and things get thrown our way. But at least gives us a shot where we can take those steps that we want to take. We can build on that foundation with some level of security.
I remember when I was thinking of the idea of the app, it's like, I wanted to do something after the tour, like what's next. And you know, I come from a planning background, you know, financial planning, that's what we did. And in financial planning, it was pretty clear. You just don't put all your eggs in one basket, right? You diversify stocks, bonds, real estate, crypto, whatever. I kind of got thrust into the mental wellness space. And the first thing I did is look at the space, you know, sit back objectively and watch these conversations, read books, watch podcasts. I realized that proliferation of everything out there was mainly treatment based. It was mainly wait till there's a problem, come rushing in to help, and then, you know, hope that works. And I'm like, well, first of all, there wasn't a lot of planning. Everything was episodic or acute. It was like, you know, if you're worried about your health and you went to the gym and you just dieted or whatever, you know, you just focused on that. And then all of a sudden these other things would come up and you'd rush over there. And then all of a sudden it was like this big game of whack-a-mole. What I saw was a big gap or a void in the mental wellness space with planning and structure. Then I thought to myself, if I were to, and this is how my brain works, if I were to make the perfect person, and let's just for the time being say young adult, so 18-year-old, what would be the three things I would focus on? In other words, what are the three biggest areas that young adults struggle in? And while I was doing the research, I was like, wow, that's never talked about though. This is never talked. It's always about breath work, meditation, sugar intake, sleep, you know, kind of the health, like you just referred to, prescriptions. It's all the health stuff. And I'm like, well, there's other things that make for a better well-being experience for the human person. And that would be a healthy relationship with money is a big one. Well, just this morning I was looking online and there's a Harvard study that came out. I'll have to do this. I don't like reading off this, but I'm going to do it. But the number one mental health challenge was a lack of meaning and purpose. So it's not health, like going to the gym or how you look in the mirror. It's your essence, like your being. You know, we have an outer purpose, which is like your doing. Like the podcast is an outer purpose for me. Mm-hmm. Your inner purpose is your essence. It's your being. It's what you see when you look in the mirror, right? When no one else is around. And there's almost 60% of young adults today lack meaning and purpose, which is tragic in a way because we have more ways to discover meaning and purpose. You know, look at AI and look at all the great information out there that you can be getting information from to figure out what your calling is in life. And second was financial worries from a Harvard study. So yeah, the two areas of the app that the wealth and the purpose in conjunction with health. So I thought that was interesting and really keeps validating as we build this out. But the challenge, as you know, being on this side, is how do you get people to, over time, be repetitive and do the work? I mean, an app is not going to solve anything, no more than a pill is going to solve anything, all right? You have to use it. You have to, you know, put in the data, put in the input, take the time. Just like if you take a prescription, you still have to do other things. You still have to go to the gym. You still have to not watch toxic TV all day long. You know, there's still things you have to do, right? It's not just one thing that's going to fix whatever ailment you have. I look at mental wellness now as a much more holistic approach. And I think MedOne, you know, you guys have had this mindset way before I came up with the idea for the app, but it meshes really well with what we're doing with Brighton. So do you think that this idea of holistic wellness planning is kind of the new frontier of how we need to be looking at improving the lived experience for the average person instead of just focusing on putting out fire after putting out fire after putting out fire? In other words, is pre-treatment more important than treatment?
Well, I think we're starting to understand the complexities of well-being mm-hmm. and of brain health, and also recognizing that some of that responsibility doesn't just fall on the individual person.
Yeah.
Meaning we may have some responsibility with each other to ensure that we're doing well, that we're in a good place. And maybe that's in response to just seeing the scope of this problem or challenge continue to grow. It may also speak to changes that our society is going through. Mm-hmm. The way that we interacted as a community is very different today than it was 20 years ago, mm-hmm. 30 years ago. And maybe some of those challenges are legitimately new or mm-hmm. new at a scale that it wasn't before. And I think with that interest, your point about pre-treatment isn't lost on me. It's not a bad one. I think that we have thought of these things in silos that, hey, you need to make sure that you're in a good headspace mm-hmm. and that is not necessarily the same issue as making sure that you have a sense of why, that you have a sense of purpose in your life. And that may not be the same issue as you are making good financial decisions.
Right, right.
But I think we're seeing that these things are all interconnected now. But I think the part that I noticed the most from my past experience is the community aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And I'll share an anecdote with you. When I was practicing in emergency medicine, one of the challenges we faced was patients coming in on back in those days, we called it mental health, a mental health watch, a suicide watch.
Yeah.
They had made some type of threat. Nobody knew what to do with the patient. So they took him to the ER and we just put him in a room.
Yeah.
And we just sat there and had a nurse sit there and watch him.
That wasn't too long ago, was it?
I mean, yeah. I mean, this was 10 years ago that I was practicing medicine. And for all I know, that is still very much the standard of care. And then those patients stay there for hours, a day, until somebody has a level of confidence that, they're probably not going to hurt themselves. But until that point, they're just there waiting.
Right.
And they need something. And I don't know that it's something that we in the emergency room had really the ability to provide to them, because we're not really administering a treatment, so to say. So one of the things that we did, because our emergency room didn't have any beds, like we had patients that were coming in that had other health conditions that needed a room, and they were taken up by patients with suicidal ideations and just under observation. So we had restructured one of our larger areas in the emergency room to be a communal observation space. And so we had now not just one patient to a room, we might have 10 to 15 patients in that room with a couple nurses that were watching and interacting and making sure that everything was going well. But one of the things that happened is now that you had these individuals together is that they're starting to converse together.
Interesting.
And they're starting to have build relationships together. And what we would often say is like, hey, what does patient so-and-so in room, 13 need? And what they need is just somebody to talk to, right? That's what they need.
Right.
The person that's in the room is just hearing their story, letting them have a place that they can release. Well, now they could be that for each other. And I recognize that, well, really what these individuals need to help them through these tough times is a confidant, somebody that they can rely on, that they can trust,
so
that they can relate to. But the problem is, especially if you've got other sorts of brain health challenges, building those relationships is really hard.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, as a child with a mom who had those issues, it was really hard for me to be there for her because it took a lot out of me to be that type of resource for her. I saw her friend group come and go and come and go and more and more go and just go and go until she had like nobody in her life. Because when you have people that have these struggles, it's just hard to maintain those relationships. They can feel so one-sided at times. And some of the behavior just crosses lines you're not willing to tolerate. And that leaves these people alone. So as I was interacting, how does this come full circle with Brighton and Med One and the partnership? As I was recognizing this need within individuals that are struggling with brain health conditions, and we have this whole new technology and artificial intelligence, it finally seems like we have a technology that is a solution for a legitimate problem that we're facing in our society, which is how do we, create a sense of engagement and, relationship that doesn't actually take away from another individual. And as I interacted in the Brighton platform and interacted with the AI component of it, I could see how somebody who's struggling and needs connection, needs relationship, needs to just tell their story and be able to vent out what they're going through. This technology can be that for them.
Right.
This technology, it not only doesn't take away from any time, energy, or resource from another human relationship, it's always there for you. Mm-hmm. And outside of some cost that's somewhere on a server, there isn't another cost there for a person to engage and have some entity to interact with and talk to. And so that opportunity to give an individual a place of release in the combination of, okay, how can we support with health, well-being, financial planning, financial wellness, all of those things in combination to then having that confident that you can interact with at any time, that I think was something that was pretty magical and special about this platform and also about this technology that's now starting to become more commonplace in our society.
Yeah, that's I keep thinking about the pressure cooker idea where as you have situations that are stressful, you just create this pressure and then you have to let some air out occasionally. And I kind of look at this AI technology and especially the mood tracking and the AI journal entry, how that just is kind of a little pressure release. Like if you're really stressed and your therapist isn't available or you're Tuesday at 2 a.m. and your parents are sleeping and you just want to release a little bit of pressure, you can go to the AI conversation. You can, the AI gets to know you over time, which is a neat feature compared to old school journaling, where you just wrote it and put it in a drawer and then pulled it out. And there was no interpretation. There was no going back in history and tying together your previous entries, which I think is a really neat bridge or tether for those people that are in the midst of struggling to get them to the next, to tomorrow. Sometimes in the mental health space, sometimes all you're trying to do is get past this obstacle. You're not really trying to get 5 years down the road because 5 hours is everything. And so what we're finding with the feedback we're getting from people that are using the app, we call them thrivers, as you well know, is it's not the end all be all, but it's something. It's an arrow in the quiver. It's that one thing that got them to the next day when the sun comes up and it's a fresh day and you kind of get a do-over button again. But it's those times that in crisis like that, that you need to have tools like this available. And then if it's a sustained problem longer term, sure, that's when the prescriptions can come in to kind of get things in balance longer. And then the hope is that you can weed those out over time, right? And get people off of the dosage they're taking and maybe a lower dose, right? So they can become more self-reliant on their own biochemistry, their own, whatever we have given to us, right? Mm-hmm. So speaking of that, I notice on your profile, you talk a little bit about your study of theology.
Oh, sure.
I'm really curious. We have never discussed this in the short time that we've got to know each other, but like your faith, like your, where does that play in all this? Obviously, you and I both have a similar goal in helping people help themselves, right? That's the goal. Where does faith come into play for you? Like how strong is faith a driver in your passion and what you do at MedOne?
Yeah, that's a really good point and question. As I mentioned earlier, I went to England and studied abroad for a year right when I was 18 years old. The context of that is it was a theology school with the intent of training people to go into ministry.
Okay.
And I would say, growing up in our family, while we weren't the type of family that went to church every Sunday, we were a faith-based family. We believed in God. We would have been non-denominational, probably evangelical leaning. But it wasn't until I was probably about, and we would go on certain holidays and sporadically we would go to church. But my grandparents were big drivers of actually our involvement because they were very involved with our church. And when I was in my early teenage years, probably about 13, our church that we had gone to got too small and they decided to close up shop and move over everybody to a bigger church that was affiliated with the same organization. My great grandmother was going to have to move from the church that she's been used to for, years over to a new church. And honestly, as a 13-year-old, I just kind of felt bad that she was going to maybe have to go through that alone, not have anybody with her. And so I offered to go with her, as she was having to go to a new church that she hadn't been to and be around a bunch of people she didn't know. And so, I started at 13, going a little bit more consistently with my great grandmother. And while this church, provided, good theology, it also provided, good music, good community. As a 13-year-old, it also had a lot of pretty girls there at the church. So I remember thinking, hey, this isn't so bad. I could get involved in this youth group. But it also provided to me an example, as I got to know people at this church, of what a stable life looked like. You know, here I've got back home, and I've got all these crazy things that are going on. And then here I go to church on Sunday, and I at least see, these people seem like they've got this life thing figured out at least a little bit better than, the example that, I've had. Now, I don't think that they all did have it figured out. I think that there's some things about how you portray yourself on Sunday versus then how you behave on Friday. But, certainly there was an attractiveness there to say, hey, I could learn some things here. So I got pretty involved, and I am very glad that that situation played out the way it did in my life, because it definitely helped me make certain decisions that I wouldn't have made otherwise had I not had those individuals supporting me, and also the example that they gave. So I, when I graduated high school at 17, and again very involved with my faith and with this community. I was set on going into ministry. I would lead a church. I would continue to support a community. And so I went to England, and I studied at a school called Capron Ray Hall, part of an organization called the Torchbearers, which is an international network of theology schools. And then upon coming back, it's a one-year program. I got waitlisted at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. So then I had a little window there where I was back home. But for that spring semester, I went to Moody. And that's where things actually did change quite a bit. So I'm probably 19, 20 years old at this point. And now we're going into churches, and we're leading conferences, and we're doing Christian Experience weekends, and we're preaching, and I would say a lot of my public speaking skills came from just a lot of formal training and getting in front of groups and preaching. But when we were starting to work in the churches, we could see kind of both sides of church leadership, of what I mentioned before, how you behave on Friday, the ways that you articulate life's challenges, versus how you then portray yourself on Sunday. And this is where some of that, that transparency, that almost, it almost is too central to the core of who I am, that, as I was, more or less encouraged to think about how you need to be perceived as an individual does not necessarily need to be the same thing of who you are and how you behave. I realized that disconnect was not something that I was willing to support. And so, I had some conversations with some key individuals at that time, around if this is the expectation of leadership within a church, if you have to ensure that you're portraying a certain image on Sunday, and if that's not the same thing as who you are at your core, then that's probably not something that I want to lend my time and talent, and certainly the next 40 years of my career, into propagating. So I dropped out and went back home and was trying to figure out, well, now what do I do with my life if I'm not going to be a minister? I'm not sure what the next step is for me. And so it took some time, and that's when I actually moved to Iowa and decided to go on the pharmacy pathway. Now, all that means, like probably most of us, we have a very complicated faith journey. My belief structure, my theology has never changed. How that applies to how we interact in our community might be very different than what, you know, a pastor might say on Sunday. I certainly believe that my role is one of lay ministry. It's to support the needs of my community. sometimes those needs are very physical, mm-hmm. and I can help them as a pharmacist and help them use a medication or get off a medication to help their physical well-being, or even brain health over, you know, my time of getting to help them. If it's something spiritual, I'm happy to be there and talk to them and support them on that front as well. But I think that what faith did for me, especially during those formative years, and I know a lot of the work you do is with young adults, college-age students, it gave me a sense of purpose.
Right.
It gave me a sense of grounding.
Yep.
There was something bigger than myself that I was contributing to. And I think that this phase of, you know, being 13 to maybe, you know, 21, if you don't have something that's bigger than yourself that you are supporting, that your time and talent goes into, that's somewhat selfless. And I mean, that doesn't have to be faith. It can be a number of things, but there's got to be something a little bit bigger than just who we are and what we are doing, in order for us to feel that sense of purpose and have that sense of purpose in our life. So faith was that for me for that phase.
Sure.
And then what's been interesting is since that time, while faith is not necessarily, diminished or gone away, how it meets my needs for that sense of purpose is very different than that time in my life. Now the things that I do that are external to myself to support, others, I do in a very different way, but that's still very much where my sense of purpose comes
Absolutely.
From.
Yeah. That permeates the culture you and Wes have built and everybody at Med One. From the moment I got involved with you guys, there was something different. I've been involved with a lot of companies at my 59 years on this planet. And I can think of maybe one or two that I would, there's one in the investment, there's two in the investment world that I would say are right up there. Just they have that it factor. You just feel it when you walk onto the campus and you meet the people and you just, you know, it's like purpose and passion before profits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the profits come if you do the other two first, right? Right. But if your only focus is profits, and you lose sight of purpose and passion, and it's just a shallow way to wherever you're going. It's just not the true path. What you guys have done at Med One is, to me, in this journey of not knowing anything about Med One, you know, just not too long ago, to now just even when we went up on campus and how welcome we were, we felt there, you know, just I think you guys have done a great job.
Not every company probably gets the privilege of choosing how they make money.
Yeah.
And in our world, there's a lot of different ways to make money as a PBM. And it's kind of interesting for us to sit there, especially as a leadership team, and challenge ourselves to say, is this the way that we want to make money? Mm-hmm. And as you talk about passion, people over profits, we look at those three elements, and we look at opportunities for our business to continue to be successful, especially financially successful. And there's many times that we reject revenue. There's many times that we say, we don't want to make money in that way because it goes against our purpose. It goes against our values.
Yeah.
We see how this creates misalignment across stakeholders. And our stakeholders are typically pharmacies, employers that are paying the bill, and then the patients themselves. Mm-hmm. And if the way that we make money creates misalignment across those parties, then we reject it. We say, well, no, that's not how we want to make money.
Right.
And that keeps our organization purpose-driven. As soon as we start saying, hey, let's make money in any way that we can, all of a sudden we've lost that sense of purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if more organizations had that mindset from the onset, you know, I know that was one of the big things for me with Brighton was building that. I use the word ecosystem a lot, building the culture, that we could be real proud of what we're building. You know, at the end of the day, obviously, you know, there's the financial stuff always happens. And, you know, as an investment guy, that's just part of the deal, but can't lose sight to the purpose behind the mission, you know, and that's, I think our two objectives are very similar. When I was at your place and I saw your 10,
core values.
Core values. Thank you. I'm reading them going, yeah, those are, might as well be ours. Might as well just put Brighton up there because we have the same core values. And we went through an exercise recently as a team with Carson and Emily. And I don't know, it was like a 2-week type process where we went through and we got down to what our core values were. And they were very mirrored to what you guys have developed. And so I guess let's leave it at this because we're kind of coming up on the time. So I want to talk a little bit about drug prices in the marketplace and where, you know, the frustration comes from the average consumer out there that just seems to be paying, you know, I know insurance covers it, but then you got to run it through the insurance and that increases the premiums in the whole game, you know, the higher the drug cost. So in a nutshell here, as we wrap this up, like what value does a really good PBM bring to the marketplace in regards to keeping prices affordable? And then I noticed you guys have a relationship with Mark Cuban's drug cost. I think it's cost plus drug company. Maybe talk a little bit about that, where you see value in that as well. And how does that complement what you guys are trying to do with Med One?
Yeah, I think it's good maybe to start and talk a little bit about where the industry is coming from. The way that insurance companies and companies like ours, we're called pharmacy benefit managers, but PBMs, have operated is not dissimilar to other types of industries, right? You buy your source product low and then you do something with it and then you mark it up and you sell it high and that difference is your revenue. Well, since we are truly middlemen that facilitate transactional relationships across parties, we don't actually like buy any products. We don't actually sell anything. But we have control over those two elements, the buying and the selling of drugs. And so even dating back to the early 90s when the industry really started, we have the internet and now we've got ways that instead of pharmacies filling out paper forms and mailing them into insurance companies, these transactions can actually occur real time. The companies that were in the middle, they identified that the business model that worked best for them was to negotiate certain pricing for the payers, and the payers might be an employer, it might be an insurance company, it might be a health plan. And they would negotiate a certain price on drugs, and then the pharmacies that are actually dispensing the drugs, they negotiate a different price with those. And so if I can sell drug A or have a pharmacy sell it, I should say, sell it to me for $5, and then I can get the payer, the employer, to pay $10, I just made $5. And when we think about department stores, I mean, that's what they do, right? They're buying jeans at, you know, probably $10 a pair and they're marking them up to $40. Yeah. It's just how business tends to work.
Right.
The reason why that's been an area of such scrutiny in our society today and why there's so much around PBM reform is because of how profitable they have been and the impact that they've had on some key stakeholders in that supply chain of access of drugs. So one key stakeholder obviously is the employer or the insurance company. And if you've looked at your premiums or if you run a company and you're looking at your renewals, you're seeing that costs just keep going up and up and up.
Yep.
Well, imagine that PBM, right? They're incentivized to see costs go up. And especially they're incentivized if they can point the blame to another entity like the drug manufacturer.
Sure.
Like, drugs costs just nothing keep going up. Yeah, what can we do about it? They're culpable. All right. Let me tell you on the record, PBMs have an influence over drug pricing. And if you are on one of these, they're called traditional models, you are incentivized to see drug pricing go up. Right. That is providing opportunity to the point that your client, right, your customer is willing to tolerate that increase of price is opportunity for you to make more money. Likewise, on the pharmacy side, the more that you're able to leverage lower levels of reimbursement to the pharmacy is also opportunity for profitability.
Yep.
So we have a big problem in our society right now. And in Iowa, where we're recording this, we're seeing a record number of community pharmacies close every year.
And I saw that.
We just passed through the House and the Senate a PBM bill. It's on the governor's desk waiting to be signed to address the challenge, which is that pharmacies are not viable. But why aren't they viable? Because the level of reimbursement, what they're getting paid for drugs from PBMs, is too low for them to keep their lights on.
Mm.
Well, how did we get there? Like, why did this be allowed to have happen? Well, there's been so much consolidation in the marketplace. Here in the state of Iowa, there's basically one PBM that dominates the entire market, and it isn't MedOne, at least not yet.
Aren't there three overall that
dominate
the market?
There's three big that dominate the entire country. Yeah. So CVS, Caremark, Express Scripts, and Optum. But those three massive corporations, you know, they can go to these pharmacies and they can say, hey, here's the deal. Either take it or leave it. Oh, by the way, if you leave it, you're going to lose 9 of every 10 patients. They can't go to your pharmacy.
They can't.
So if you're the pharmacy, like what do you do?
Right.
And for a lot of years, they just take the cruddy deal and hope they can make it up in other ways, make it up on volume. Problem is, if you're losing money on every prescription, more volume doesn't help you, right? You just go out of business faster.
Right. Yeah.
And we're at that inflection point. We've talked when I was in pharmacy school, this is now, 10, 15 years ago, we were talking about how this was a race to the bottom and what happens when we get there. Like, I think we're there. We're at the bottom, and these pharmacies are showing that they can't be viable. Now, some pharmacies can because they've diversified, and you've got pharmacies that either are owned by or own PBMs, and they can offset those losses, right? So there's some dynamics at play there, that enough vertical integration and you can take certain losses and still be okay as an entire entity.
Right.
But a lot of these community independent pharmacies don't have that. They can't offset these losses. So anyways, that's part of why drugs are so expensive, right? It's not because the pharmacies are making hay, right? The pharmacies are not making hay. They're barely making it.
And that's what most people would probably assume.
Most people would think like, oh yeah, all these pharmacists are probably just rolling in it, and you know, they own three houses and they are going on crazy vacations. Like, no, they're doing their best, especially in that community pharmacy space. And then employers, right? The health plans, the insurance companies are paying more for medications than they have before. But the PBMs are the ones that negotiate the deals, right? They're the ones who say, here's what your rate's going to be on both sides of those equations. And where things, changed, I would say, in the late 90s when MedOne was founded, was let's make that contract pass through. Let's make it so that whatever the employer's paying, whatever the health plan's paying, dollar for dollar is exactly what's going to the pharmacy. You take away the opportunity for a PBM to make hidden revenue in the middle. Just like you don't know how much Kohl's is making on every pair of jeans, you don't know how much a PBM is making on the prescription drugs that you're spending. By making it pass through, now you have transparency, meaning you know exactly how much your drugs are costing. You know that the PBM is only making money in the ways that maybe you want them to make money. And you know exactly how much they're making. So that's where our model, and where these models that are really advocating for additional reform come in, is saying, because of the traditional model, which actually does create some misaligned incentives across some key stakeholders. Probably the one for me that is most personal is if you're a PBM that's making, let's say, you know, on average $5 to $10 on every transaction that goes through, on the cost of drugs, you want more transactions to go through, which means from a clinical perspective, you want patients to fill more medications, not less. But we as pharmacists recognize that people are generally on more medications than they should be. A lot of work that pharmacists do is in de-escalation of care, not escalation of care. And so
that's another stigma, I think, is out there in
that the PBMs want, or that pharmacists want patients on more medications. Generally, no, they don't. They want patients on the right medications. And so there's a lot of adjustments of treatment plans, a lot of de-escalation of care. But the PBMs in general don't want that. They want people filling more medications, not less. And then we haven't even talked about rebates and how that plays into things. But you've got drug manufacturers that are willing to cut checks back to the PBMs to promote the sales of their products. I mean, they're basically a bribe to sell more.
We had that in the investment business too, real estate investment trusts, annuity companies, you know, they would give us an incentive to sell their product over somebody else. And that got really pushed back to the point where it's not even an issue today as much as it was.
Yeah, and it's still an issue today in the pharmacy world, though with regulation and reform, hopefully the same thing happens. It becomes a non-issue moving forward. Costs of drugs go down because we're not seeing these major kickbacks going to PBMs to then promote the sale of more products and often more expensive products. So you mentioned Mark Cuban's Cost Plus Drugs. So we've partnered with him for and his organization there for a number of years, mainly because his pricing's really good.
Yeah.
And it's public.
Yeah.
And we're already passed through and transparent, meaning we're not making any money whether or not you fill at his pharmacy or you fill at my pharmacy, you fill at, you know, another pharmacy in your community. Med One doesn't make any more or less on any of those situations. So it's a good partnership for us because if he's got the best price out there, especially on these really high cost specialty medications.
I've seen some of them are ridiculous. Yeah, the difference.
He just released a cancer medication, the generic version of it. And up until his price point went out in the market, it was still thousands of dollars.
Right.
I mean, $8,000 a month for this treatment for a certain type of blood cancers. Mm-hmm. He throws his price point out there, drops it from an $8,000 a month drug to a $600 a month drug.
I saw that.
That's transformative.
Yeah.
When you think about access to care and affordability and what that means for now,
it's everything.
Patients who might need a more expensive drug, but just overnight when that price hit our system and we moved our patients over to Cost Plus Drugs, it was a $23 million impact on our clients. That's how much aggregate spend went down on just one drug going generic.
That's amazing. And
you know, we need more of that type of behavior to help reduce costs, both the transparency side of it, but then also people like Mark Cuban that are willing to put the true cost of these drugs out there in the market.
Yeah.
That puts pressure on everybody to take a lower cut on those drugs. Because if he can buy it and sell it for $600, keep in mind, all these major corporation mail order specialty pharmacies can buy and sell it at that price point too.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the market share that these other entities do. He just has the willingness to take less profitability on it in order to ensure more patients have affordable access to care. So that works really well with our model. He has a saying, I've heard him say it on meetings and when we go and meet with employers with him on the meeting, he has to win our business every day. And we feel that way too. So if my pharmacy can get the lowest cost, great. I won your business today. If I can't, it's going to go somewhere else that beat me because you shouldn't have to pay more. A patient shouldn't have to pay more just because I have the opportunity to make you fill at a particular pharmacy.
Yeah, I actually, I'll talk to you later about my potential connection with Mark Cuban. So got someone that has referred me to him to talk to him.
Oh, great.
I think this space that we're in, he would be interested in something like this just because of the holistic view we bring and so forth. But I was curious to ask you that Mark Cuban question today. So I think as we wrap this up, I can tell looking at my list, I didn't get to anywhere of my questions, but you know what? That's why I like what I do because I think it's good for people to see the leader behind organizations or a leader behind organizations kind of what makes you get out of bed in the morning? What keeps you going? What's your ultimate, you know, what's your end game? What's your goal? Instead of sitting here for, you know, an hour talking about all the intricacies of the app or about Med One's, you know, business model or something, I think it's important to talk about the why. That's really important today, what's missing. As a leader of an organization, what would you say to somebody right now that is either a leader or someone just struggling at work or trying to figure out their meaning and purpose in life, have a better experience that they're having? What words of wisdom would you give from your breadth of experiences that you've had? Are there any nuggets of wisdom you would put out there to help people get through and, you know, not just survive, but to actually thrive, you know?
Yeah, I think very generally speaking, I would encourage anybody to have the confidence to pivot if they recognize that the situation they're in is not what they want to be in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that there's few things as detrimental to your well-being as feeling trapped.
Mm.
When you feel like you've desperate. Got no options.
Right.
And one of the things that my dad would tell me growing up as we looked at the various challenges we faced as a family is he would say, look, I'm just playing the cards that I'm dealt.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
And I kind of had that ingrained in my mind, which creates a very passive view of your circumstance.
I would agree.
You know,
yeah.
I don't control these things that are in my life. I just try to make
pseudo victim mindset almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would say about when I was 20 years old, I had the light bulb moment where I said, well, why don't I just change the game?
Yeah.
Right. If these are the cards I'm getting dealt,
right.
Like
a new game,
I'm going to go play a different game then.
Yeah. That's good.
Which speaks to a mindset of when your circumstances are not what you want them to be, not what you're proud of.
Yeah.
Have the courage to pivot and do something that's different.
Sounds like stoicism in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just that reframing your situation.
Yeah. And understanding, like, you've got to scope the level of effort. You've got to make sure that you've got the support and the community. But I would say you have to believe in yourself to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've probably got to do it again and again and again. Yeah. I've had a lot of pivots in my life.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'm not done with the pivots that I'm going to have. Yeah. But don't settle to be unhappy. Look at the things in your life that are posing those challenges. Have the courage to take some steps, baby steps at first,
mm-hmm.
to meaningfully change that. So eventually you get to a place where you're happier. Now, I don't know that I'm ever truly super happy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just happier than I was.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it'll look like if I ever achieve some sense of full happiness. Like, this is the happiest I ever could possibly be.
It just turns into joy and peace.
Yeah.
Because happiness in a way is so short.
I kind of view like it's something I'm always working towards.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I wish maybe that's part of my brain health journey is mm-hmm. knowing that it's always something I work towards, but never something that I fully think I'm going to be able to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
But that means that I'm always taking steps in that direction,
mm-hmm.
Because I feel like I don't really have any other choice other than to not head in that direction and then settle being unhappy about certain things in my life. And that's just something I'm not willing to do.
Well, Living Undeterred was born from the idea of choices and the two roads that we are confronted all day long, left or right, you know, this or that, drink or not drink, you know, lie or tell the truth, you know, it's like, or as I like to say, you know, victim or victor, mm-hmm. or bitter or better. It's like, which road are you on? You know, if you're on the better road, that's a victor mindset. You can do anything. Things are opportunity. Things happen for you. Whereas if you're a victim, that's the bitter road, and things happen to you versus for you. And again, it's two roads. Which one are you going to take? And unfortunately, you know, I've got some dear loved ones in my life that are no longer here that took mm-hmm. one road, and I decided they didn't want to join them just yet. So I took the other road. But I think we're all presented these choices every day. And that was really the backbone of the cornerstone behind this podcast idea, was just to listen to you share your story, which is, I could talk all day about this, but I think people watching this can now see a different, you know, different person behind what they see on the LinkedIn profile or a title in someone's name, which is just a label, you know. But anyway, Dr. Nate, this has been a pleasure. Really appreciate the time you took. And I think this is going to be a popular podcast. And one of my goals was to get people to learn a little bit more about PBMs, mm-hmm. But also just to get to know you a little bit better, more intimately. And we are at Brighton, I can speak on behalf of our growing team that we are absolutely honored to have this opportunity to help you assist people in their increasing their experiences. And we've learned a lot, learning from you guys as well, mm-hmm. to make Brighton the best that we can. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Appreciate it, man.
Yeah.
Thanks.